It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
Welcome to Cultural Baggage. I am Dean Becker, and this is the Unvarnished Truth. Our engineer tonight, Steve Nolan. Cheryl and Tammy are manning the phones and the computers, and I welcome you. Our guest tonight is Greg Gladden, the president of the Texas American Civil Liberties Union. In 2 weeks, our guest will be Mark Stepnoski, the former center of the Dallas Cowboys and now president of Texas Normal. And now for a little news.
Some of the most important, I think, is the release yesterday of the Canadian House of Commons report on the decriminalization of marijuana. And what they've determined parallels so closely what the Canadian Senate report gave us in September, where they actually called for legalization. Seems they're going to wade into the waters a bit slowly, but they're wading in nonetheless. Here in the U.S., we have... you know, so many people that fight for the right to lie to us on a daily basis. It starts with the DEA's office on down, because otherwise their job is, less useful to the society. I want to go ahead and play a little bit of the Canadian Commons report for you right now.
It's decriminalization, not legalization, but it is still controversial. The committee's chair described how the new rules might work.
The committee heard that the prosecution of cannabis-related offenses takes up too much of our scarce criminal justice resources. We want the prosecution of the new regulatory offense to be done through the issuance of tickets. Fines would be paid without a court appearance, and enforcement would not result in a criminal conviction. The committee hopes that these changes will free police and judicial resources to pursue other, more serious criminal activity. The current framework for dealing with substance use and misuse do not appear to be achieving the goals of Canadians and for themselves and for their communities. We hope that the government of Canada and all Canadians will see our recommendations as constructive, practical, and compassionate, a serious way to deal with the serious problems that we think are occurring right across this country.
Well, we've seen police chiefs right across the country saying, look, we need to focus on the big crime, and we're not going to, can't spend a lot of time on small-scale possession. And in fact, that's what has been happening in practice here in British Columbia. For the most part, police don't chase down cases of small-scale possession because they are too busy trying to keep up with this growth in grow operations and the like. So
the line that's been presented to Americans as well as Canadians...
Play that here in just a bit. Now... Here's a partial quote I got from David Borden. He's the executive director at drcnet.org. And here's a quote from him. I can't help but get a little embarrassed, though mostly entertained, when United States drug warriors say ridiculous things in other countries that make them look stupid. One such drug warrior was Representative Mark Souter. He told members of the Canadian Senate Committee last July that BC Bud, the British Columbia's famous high-grade marijuana, is as dangerous as cocaine, threatening Canada with a tighter border crackdown if they proceeded with decriminalization. Two of Souter's partners in comedy, U.S. drug czar John Walters and former Family Research Council VP and Bush drug policy advisor Robert McGinnis, were loud in Canada's news this week as they sounded desperate. Walters warned that liberalizing drugs would hurt Canadians, begging them, don't repeat our pain. We're going to clamp down even stronger on our border if you liberalize and contribute to what we consider to be a drug tourism problem. He continued to say, I don't want to get to the point where we're calling for a boycott of Canadian products.
The line that's been presented to Americans as well as Canadians is marijuana is not a serious drug of abuse. That's not true. You can't be addicted to marijuana. That's not true. That's archaic views of what marijuana was left over from the Cheech and Chong years of the 70s. Today, we have to not be subject to reefer madness, and forget the fact that high-potency marijuana in particular is being used by teenagers at younger and younger ages. The brain science we have shows it's a dependency-producing substance. We do not need, on either side of the border, more of our citizens harmed. More Canadians are likely to be harmed if consumption continues to go up. The view that if we relax our effort, we suggest send the message that marijuana is not a serious threat. If we say that use and possession is something that we're going to diminish, as the United States has done in the past, there is no question that common sense and history show the same thing. You get more marijuana use. You get more marijuana-impaired drivers on the highway doing harm. You get more young people whose lives are taken off track as a result of marijuana use and frequently other drug use. You get more communities. We in the United States have had 25 years of painful experience. No family, no community, no nation is better off with more drug use. People who've tried to tell Americans marijuana is not something you got to pay attention to, it's a lie.
The great truth from the great drug czar. Walters and McGinnis should be worried. Support for Decrim rises to the highest levels of government. It has popular support. Indeed, many Canadians, like the Senate committee, don't feel it goes far enough. The House of Commons Special Committee recommendations to leave in place all the harms from drug prohibition. So what happens is you perpetuate the grow houses, you perpetuate the Asian gangs and the biker gangs by continuing to make it illegal. Legalization is the only way to stop that crime and the violence. Here's a little bit from our friend who was with us earlier this year, along with the Canadian Senator Pierre-Claude Nolan. Here we're going to hear from Eugene Oscapella.
Here's a report from Eugene Oscapella, the head of the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy, who, along with Canadian Senator Pierre-Claude Nolan, was our guest back in September to discuss the release of the Canadian Senate report that called for the legalization of marijuana. Here, Eugene is discussing the use of safe injection sites. As outlined in the newly released report from the House of Commons in Canada.
Basically, if you look at our ultimate goal is to preserve life, to prevent people from killing themselves, and then to prevent the spread of disease. And safe injection sites or drug consumption rooms will do that. They give people who are going to use drugs, I mean, let's face it, some people are going to use drugs, it gives them a clean, safe environment in which to use those drugs. And it also acts as a portal, as an entry point into treatment if they want to get help. So it gives them a point of contact with a system that could help them through treatment or other measures. Well, I don't think anybody who's a heavy drug user doesn't really want to continue using in that sense. This is giving them the chance to preserve their health until such point as they are able to withdraw from drug use or to reduce their consumption to less, or to change their consumption patterns to less dangerous forms of consumption. So I don't think there is necessarily a line, and it's certainly not going to be an attraction to people who don't use drugs. The notion of going down to a safe injection site is not going to appeal to somebody who's contemplating using drugs, so it's not going to be an attraction to new users, certainly.
When asked why not go whole hog, why not provide the drugs as well, here's what Eugene had to say.
Well, that's exactly the point. I would like to see just that. I think it would cost society far less if people could get clean, pure drugs in those situations. And, I mean, this seems radical, but it's not radical. It's radical only vis-a-vis the United States. It's not radical when you look at Europe, where they've had this in Switzerland. They've got it in they've had it for many, many years in England with their heroin maintenance programs and even cocaine maintenance there. They have it in the Netherlands now. So this is something that countries are coming around to. We're going to save society a lot of money in the long run. We're going to save lives and we're going to prevent the spread of disease, which doesn't just affect drug users, but actually, eventually these diseases spread into the general community. So we're protecting everybody by helping people who use drugs. Well, if you take the example of Switzerland, for example, where they've had heroin maintenance programs, and basically people could go in and get clean, pure heroin injected in under safe, sanitary conditions. The rate of HIV infection amongst users has plummeted to virtually nil. Their level of criminal activity has plummeted because they don't need to spend all their time running around trying to commit crimes to get the money to pay the exorbitant price of heroin on the black market. Their health improves. Their social circumstances improve. Many of them are able to go back to their families. Many of them are able to go back to work. These people can function again in society if they get a clean, safe supply of the drug. Well, this isn't a question of safe injection sites or rehabilitation. We absolutely need both. I mean, there's totally inadequate treatment in this country. This has to be part of a continuum of safe injection sites, treatment facilities, education, a whole shifting away from this prohibitionist notion of dealing with drugs and treating it as a health issue, which involves a whole continuum of services. We don't need another U.S.-style drug czar. I mean, if you're worried about the waste of money on the gun registry, we've wasted far more on drug prohibition. We need somebody who's got a health focus, who wants to look at drugs as a health issue. And that's always been the rhetoric of the government of Canada, despite the fact that we spend the vast majority of the federal money on law enforcement. The rhetoric has always been to treat drugs as a health issue. We need to turn the rhetoric into reality, really.
Okay, I have an additional quote from Eugene Oscafella of the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy. He was speaking of drug reform, and he said, quote, "It's not clear if the police will still be able to kick your door down, throw you up against the wall, arrest you, and then write you a traffic ticket." One other thought I want to relay here before we bring in Greg. This is a quote I got from my friend. His nickname's Guitar God. He's on the New York Times Drug Policy Forum. This is a quote from him. Quote, "When justice one day reigns supreme, and Ashcroft, Hutchison, Walters, and Trent Lott will be able to frolic naked in the sun-dappled desert of Iraq, tickling each other into ecstasy with fresh odoriferous buds as Saddam Hussein sings sweetly, born in the USA, what will we do then?" Well, That's my theory. These guys are just looking for some paradise, and I hope they find it, I suppose. Greg, thank you for coming down to Cultural Baggage. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, sir.
To be here.
Yes, sir. I've got a ton of news. I wish I had a daily show, to be honest with you. There's so much good news. People talk about the fact that the Question 9 in Nevada was defeated and defeated in Arizona, but there's... I do want to share this right quick, and it'll give us some talking points as well. But the whole point being that there is a lot of good news in the U.S. these days. I'm just going to read these off. Well, worldwide, Britain drops old drug strategy, targets goals that are credible. Michigan legislature repeals draconian minimum mandatory sentences. New Jersey court declares state civil forfeiture funding scheme is unconstitutional. Massachusetts High Court blocks arrest of needle exchange participants. In Colombia, it's the drug war. No, it's the oil war. No, it's the terror war. That's not a story necessarily. Illinois Supreme Court limits use of drug dogs in traffic stops. Paramilitary drug raid tactics anger Eugene residents up in Canada. Support. That's enough. That's from today's news. And I guess my point being, you know, there is a lot of progress. There is a lot of truth being exposed that the drug warriors have hidden for so long. Tulia is a prime example. Please tell us what's happening up there. It seems it's a slow, tedious process.
Well, let me first say that I think you're right. And unfortunately, it seems like one war often distracts from another war.
Yes.
Just like the war on drugs distracted us from the war on poverty or on illiteracy. I think probably people are rethinking what we should really fear. The ACLU, I know, is very energized nationally around what our government is doing in this their war on terror, aside from having to address head on some of those attacks on civil liberties, it has given us an opportunity to rethink some of the war on drugs legislations and laws that were passed when that was capturing the American attention. In Texas, we have an exciting time coming up in that the legislature is about to, I say exciting, the legislature meets in January. It meets 6 months out of every 2 years. In the last legislative session, the ACLU, working with other organizations, passed about six pieces of legislation that made Texas a better place. And we'll talk about some of those in a minute. Some of them address Tulia and some of the drug war tools. This year, we're going to be focusing on sentence reduction for nonviolent crimes. And we think we have an opportunity to rethink our prison system and how many people we have locked up for marijuana or other drug crimes that don't involve any dishonesty or any violence, and try to get the legislature to make room, or at least to rethink who we need to be locking up, and that will be our primary effort. And I don't think I'm giving anything away by talking about it at this point. There have been bills already introduced that the ACLU is backing, and in fact has authored some of those that will address the terrible situation of having nonviolent, honest people locked up because what they like to do in their recreational time.
Yes, I understand that. You know, there is the legal side of this question that needs exploring, that needs change. But there is also the economic side, which is, in this time of shortage and budget shortfalls, is proving the other necessity that we have too many people, that we can't afford to pay to house so many people. The way I understand it, we have more black people locked up than they did in South Africa under apartheid. And yet nobody seems embarrassed or worried about it. They were willing to spend the money until the War of Terror.
Well, if we can change that, I don't really care whether they're voting with us because they want to save money for the state or they have to save money for the state on the prison industrial complex that has been such a growth industry in Texas for so long now, or if it's a matter of conscience, or because they agree with some of our ideas about consenting adults shouldn't be told what to do in their bedrooms and in their living rooms. And the ACLU has always been on the forefront of leading the fight against the drug war, because government shouldn't be in the business of telling consenting adults what they do in the privacy of their own home for their recreation. You mentioned Tulia, and we can we had two pieces of legislation. Tulia is a small town in North Texas, and I hope most people have heard about it. It's gotten a lot of news. The ACLU picked up a story that was first run in the Texas Observer about one particular bad news police officer that was kind of going from task force to task force and losing his job because he wasn't a very good police officer, and he was left town owing a lot of money in one place, and two sheriffs he had worked under had put letters in his T-close file, his licensing file in Austin, that this man should never be in the business of policing ever again. But he shows up with this one of these task forces that are one of the tools that came into being as a result of the war on drugs. It shows up in North Texas on this task force and proceeds to, over a period of a year, he says, he makes a list of people in town that he keeps written on his leg, people who have allegedly sold him small amounts of cocaine. And at the end of that year-long investigation that he did on his own, without any corroboration, without any marked money, without any tape recordings, without any backup officers, he presents his leg list of people, and they're virtually all black except for I think one that was married, a man that was white man that was married to a black woman, ends up indicting one third of the black population of this small town of Tulia for being dope pushers.
Greg, I understand that they actually found, when they busted all these people, they found no drugs, no guns, no money of any appreciable amount in any of the homes.
And then they started taking him to trial, and people started, the juries, all white juries that sat in judgment, ended up handing out enormous sentences for these people. And other people began to try to cut their losses and plead guilty to 5 and 10 and 12-year sentences so they wouldn't get 40 and 50-year sentences
right.
from the juries, and were actually literally pleading guilty to things that they probably did not do, and in fact sometimes they absolutely did not do. Some of the people that were indicted as a result of the investigation were actually standing in line to get food stamps in another state, and you know, signing for the food stamps, and were like nowhere. They weren't even in the state at the time. They were alleged to have been in Tulia selling drugs, and the thing started unraveling. There are still some people in jail as a result of that, but there have been probably 30 cases, or not quite 30, probably 20 cases that have been dismissed after Deputy Coleman or Officer Coleman's credibility became public knowledge, or his lack of credibility. We had a bill called the Tulia Bill that would have required a police officer's testimony to have some corroboration, a single police officer's testimony to have some corroboration, some other evidence linking the defendant to the crime before they could be convicted. And it wouldn't take much. Say they ran. That could be evidence of guilt when they tried to arrest him. Or, you know, some marked money, or a backup officer, or a wire, some eavesdropping device. With all of the money and the powers of the state of Texas, you would think they could get some corroboration above and beyond a single police officer's testimony. Now, any good prosecutor would talk to a jury panel about a single, convicting someone on the word of a single witness. And what they do is they talk about the woman who is raped.
Right.
In the park, or they talk about the woman whose purse gets snatched in the lonely parking garage at night. And of course, those people aren't saddled with the credibility problems that co-defendants have, for instance.
Sure.
Accomplices that want to deflect their own guilt and put it on someone else, on the co-defendant. And in Texas, forever, you cannot be convicted on the word of an accomplice. That accomplice testimony has to be corroborated. Well, we thought, in light of what Coleman had done up in Tulia, that the time was ripe to take a hard look at the credibility of these police officers that are engaged in the highly competitive business of ferreting out crime. And it's made more competitive by this system of grants, federal grants, that are funding these task forces, where the money they get from the government through the governor's office is based on the number of arrests they make. At any rate, that was one bill, corroboration of police officer, requiring corroboration of a police officer. The police officers around the state and the prosecutors around the state took some offense to us even presenting such a bill, and that did not pass. But another case was very similar to the Tulia case. Was we call it the Hearn case. Another task force, rather than having a rogue policeman go into the projects and claim all the black people were dealing drugs, they would. Someone would get arrested. They'd say, well, we need our numbers to go up. If you'll give us 15 other dopers, or make 15 cases for us, we'll let you go. And so then those 15 people, they would do the same thing with those 15 people. And so you had informants doing the setting people up and getting people arrested and prosecuting and testifying against people, with the police sitting back and really not having any independent investigation of whether it's true.
And certainly they would have no concern for the rights of those people they're setting up, or whether it even happened. They're just basically trying to get the weight off their own back.
Right, and the police seem to have more concern about fattening up their numbers so they could get more grant money on these, for these task forces. So, at any rate, in Hearn, Texas, not far from here, the task force was using people like that, and one particular bad informant was just making stuff up. He was going down into the housing projects and putting cases on people that he actually had never met, and was just making stuff up. So, and when it came to light, when he got caught, when someone finally took him to trial, and a good defense lawyer exposed his deceptions, it resulted in the prosecutor deciding maybe this guy's not a good witness, and some ACLU lawyers went up, and as a result of some pleadings we filed both with Attorney General Ashcroft, asking him to look into it, and the Attorney General here in Texas. The DA dismissed 17 charges, and 17 men walked out of jail the same day up in Hearn. So we had a bill the last session to say government informants, people working for under police officer supervision, they're not police officers, but they're informants. Whether they're doing it for money or they're doing it for some slack in their own with their own problems. As of September 1 of last year, and this bill did pass, as of September 1 of last year, you cannot be convicted in Texas based solely on the word of a government informant. There has to be some corroboration. That law was recently reviewed by an appellate court here in Houston. Unfortunately, not only was I president of the ACLU when our organization, along with some other organizations, got that law passed, but I had the fortune of being involved in the first case that the courts took a look at, a man named Marion Young, who got 35 years based on the word of an informant who had recorded a dope deal, said it was him on the tape, said he was the one that sold him 20 grams of cocaine. The jury believed him. The judge sentenced him to 35 years, and because the case was tried after September 1 of last year, the Court of Appeals said if you take everything the informant said and set it aside, no one else said that that was him on the tape. He did not testify, so you couldn't guess at whether that sounds like him or not, and that none of the police officers said that they recognized his voice. So if you just set aside the informant's testimony, there was no corroboration linking him with any evidence of crime, and the Court of Appeals about 2 weeks ago reversed the case and ordered him acquitted and released.
Wonderful.
We have been vindicated because of things like the Dallas Sheetrock scandal. Some people may have heard about an informant up there that was paid $200,000.
Great. Could I interrupt you one second? I do want to hear about that story. You bet. I just want to notify our listeners out there that we do want your calls. Please call in here to 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. And we'll also try to pick up a question off a drug sent you all. Hope you're listening in tonight. Before you go on to the Dallas Sheetrock scan, I want to ask you a quick question. These task force officers, are they policemen? Are they a posse? Are they paramilitary? I mean, they run hog wild out there. I'm wondering who and what they are.
Well, the military is not supposed to be in the business of enforcing laws domestically. Posse comitatus is the concept. J. Edgar Hoover wouldn't let his FBI agents investigate drug business during his lifetime because of the corruption potential it would have on his policing.
Mm-hmm.
Since Ronald Reagan, there a couple of things have happened. The whole forfeiture, asset forfeiture, seizure and forfeiture laws that basically creates pirates for the crown. You go out and seize the ship and split it with the crown and you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
They basically have turned policemen loose to take your home, your farm, your car, your money if they can somehow link it to some illicit activity, particularly the drug business. That generated an enormous amount of motivation for agencies to get involved in that collection business.
Sure.
These task forces came into being and around the seizure forfeiture stuff. They're supposed to be seizing dope, but they did a lot more, and they do a lot more seizing property. And everyone wants to get into the act. So they've set up these task forces that are really not well supervised. There's not a structure to supervise them. But you have people pitching in, and you'll have someone from the feds, say DEA or ATF or IRS or INS. But then you'll also have people from the state level, the Department of Public Safety, maybe the Texas Rangers. Then you'll have locals, like the Sheriff's Department, Harris County Sheriff, HPD, and then you'll have, you know, the really locals. You'll have the Jersey Village Police wanting one or two of their guys to be a part of the task force, because depending on how many people from Jersey Village are on that 20 or 30 or 50 person task force, they'll get their percentage of the funds and the property that's seized. And then there's all this grant money to fund those task forces. They're really getting money from both ends, and it's really a the money is the motivation.
Sure,
it creates jobs, and it it's mutated the whole concept of police being in the business of trying to make society healthier and safer. When they're really more interested in trying to pad their pockets for the department and for themselves individually.
Certainly. Well, let's see. We just lost a caller. Go ahead and punch up line one, Steve. I don't see a name. Good evening, caller. You've reached Cultural Baggage. Do you have a question for Greg Gladden?
I actually do. My question is, how does the pharmaceutical industry influence the way politicians treat the sort of black market drug trade and the effect that it has on them as far as a corporation, and if this has something to do with the way that people are persecuted? If I'm kind of making my point, it just seems like it. Are they a big influence on our politicians on how they treat people who get drugs illicitly, as they would say?
Well, I believe certainly they have a vested interest. They have exerted their power not only in they don't have anything to gain by marijuana being legalized. They can't bottle it and sell it and control it the way they can drugs that they create and manufacture themselves. You know, they've had a lot of influence on or a lot of impact on the herbal remedies. They have exerted some efforts to try to go after people who are who profess in all these herbal medicines.
Homeopathics and exactly.
I'm sorry, say it again.
The homeopathy and everything.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think probably they have the most to lose by. I mean, if either street drugs or ancient herbal remedies that they don't grow and produce take a piece of their business or market share, you know, they're not going to like it. Just like. I mean, and it's not just limited to them. I mean, Bayer Aspirin didn't like all the business Tylenol stole from them. I mean, it's part of capitalism, and certainly our government is founded on that concept, and politicians are an integral part of that that system.
Well,
I'm not sure if I answered your question, but
no, you did. I just think that. A lot of times that the pharmaceutical corporations and their lobbyists tend to make everything seem, you know, they skew everything to their point of view, and how, as you said earlier, they don't ever try to treat the subjects. They would rather throw them all in jail. And
well, you know, there are some wacky people in every type of business, and in the among the drug warriors, you know, DEA, there have been some. I mean, they have come in contact with the pharmaceutical industry too. I mean, they prosecute doctors for prescribing more pain medication than someone dying of cancer needs, according to their lights. That is the DEA's lights. I mean, they've. I think
that's to stop euthanasia on a moral issue, I assume. If you were to prescribe painkillers where you could actually take more than you needed to decide to take your own life.
Right. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies are their vested interest is obvious, and it's a part of the capitalist system. I'm more troubled by making our police and our government into pirates, and making them into people that, I mean, you know, a lot of people think that the 13th Amendment did away with slavery in this country, but if you read it, it says it speaks in terms of doing away with indentured servitude, and but then there's a comment that says, except for the commission of serious crimes. And so we still have a slave state, and who gets bound into slavery is dependent on what laws we pass and who gets prosecuted for violating those laws. And I just hate the idea of us paying and spending and setting up our government to enslave our own people for nonviolent, non-dishonest behavior.
The industrial prison complex.
Right.
So true. Okay. Well, I want to thank you, caller.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Okay, I want to remind you out there listening, please give us a call, 713-526-5738. We do have some lines open. We have Tori on line 3. Hello, Tori.
Hey, I love your show.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you listening in. Do you have a question for Mr. Gladden?
I just wanted to comment, a couple of comments, on the cynicism of the drug war. It's like, you know, it's all about drug control in the worst sense. It's about, like, mafia want to control their market. You know, they want to eliminate the competition. And it's like there's our cartels that we work with and Colombia, you know, the CIA's cartels, and then there's the bad ones, and they're the ones that they go after, and they just keep allowing the dope to come in. But it seems like they just want to control it. And on the drug war is about getting rid of the ones, the dope dealers that are, you know, not on our team. And anyway, that was one comment. Another thing is a little anti-war, anti-drug war Christmas carol I thought you might enjoy. Very short.
All right.
What if baby Jesus was an Iraqi child? Just another deal with the devil. Arm some poppy warlords from the stands. The young'uns in America will revel. Now the drug war has had a change in plans. The Afghani farm aid bill just passed Congress. Swords turn into plowshares to plant dope. War junkies making nightmares in the White House. But while you're dreaming, there still seems like there is hope. And that's it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to call in and share that with us. And I want to wish everybody out there, this is my last show before Christmas, and I do want to hope you have a safe and happy holiday. We're going to have a little bit of music here in a little bit, I hope. You know, I think you're right. That was it John I was talking to here? I guess he's gone. Okay, but anyway, I appreciate the call. Greg, just a quick thought, if you would, the sheetrock scandal in Dallas. That seems to have tainted the DA's office, the cops, the FBI was looking at it. Nobody's, just like Tulia, has an answer. It takes forever and a year to do a study.
Well, it vindicated the ACLU and the other organizations that worked for the passage of certainly the Hearn Law, dealing with requiring corroboration of informants, because in Dallas, for those of listeners that may not be as familiar with it as some of us are, an informant working for the police was going out making cases on people and basically going after Hispanics, and was claiming, he would come back and say that, you know, this guy sold me a kilo of cocaine and have a brick of white powder, and the police were kept giving him money, and he kept going and allegedly spending it on cocaine, and they'd give him money as a reward as well. And $200,000 later of money that they had, kind of a slush fund they had to do this kind of stuff, that he pocketed, it turns out someone had an independent analysis done of all these kilos and kilos and kilos of cocaine that were the evidence supporting all of these busts in Dallas, and there were a whole bunch of them. And it wasn't cocaine at all. It was gypsum or sheetrock.
Right.
And allegedly the police didn't know anything about it. I'm not sure I believe that. They had all this money they had spent. They had all these cases and these people sitting in jail. That was just a sham. So that case came down and that scandal came out after the legislature had gone along with us and passed the Hearn law. So at least the informants that they use around the state of Texas now will have to. You can't be convicted of a dope case in September 1 of last year unless the state has some corroboration that you were connected with the crime. Things have run amok, and it's not just Dallas and Tulia. It's everywhere.
Yes, it is. Greg, we got a couple more callers. John, line one. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, John. Do you have a question for us?
Sure do.
Yes, sir.
Hey, just wondering how you thought, assuming that the Canada achieves their marijuana decriminalization, how that would affect and possibly aid the reform movement here.
Well, it's certainly a step in the right direction. The legalization of marijuana, they can't, they're probably, well, how would it affect it? They're probably our closest neighbor in more ways than one, in that they speak the same language and have a lot of the same history that we do, and their legal system has sprung from the same loins as ours. And I suspect it would help the effort. I think probably back when Britain tried something new with heroin and were making it available to users, I think that had a significant impact on at least the debate in this country.
Right.
Of course, there are people that argue both ways, that it made England a safer, better place, and others would argue that it did not. But I've heard both those arguments. I think it would certainly aid the debate. I think I think Canadians are viewed in this country as a civilized society in more ways than one, more civilized than the United States in many ways. If anyone has seen Michael Moore's new movie, Bowling for Columbine, he talks about Canadians being a country of 20 million people that owned 7 million guns, but they only had 100 gun deaths last year, whereas the United States had 12 or 15,000. And he took the NRA's slogan about guns don't kill people do, and changed it to guns don't kill people, Americans do, both domestically and internationally.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, hoping that at least raise awareness here that, hey, marijuana is less harmful than alcohol, and the great injustice that creates laws the way they are.
Well, it can't help but help to bring about the change. John, I thank you. We're running out of time. I'm going to have to go to my last caller here.
Okay,
thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
And once again, we have John online, too. Hello.
The different John, though.
Yes.
Question for Greg Gladden.
Yes, please.
Just something crossed my mind, and, you know, you just brought up something similar. In regards to the Bowling for Columbine movie, one of the people that Michael Moore interviews is one of the, I'm not sure if he's a producer or whatnot, but one of the big wigs on the Cops TV show. And he asks him, you know, why don't you do a show on, bad cops or something. I forget what it was, but, you know, it was kind of humorous. And he said, oh, well, that wouldn't make good ratings. But, you know, what comes to my mind is, whenever I'm watching Cops, I watch them, you know, from my little legal layman standpoint, just trample on people's rights, left and right. It seems like they have no regard for the law. And I wonder, you know, like, where does the ACLU stand on that? And, you know, what can we do to defend ourselves?
Well, I've never watched Cops, but I'm familiar with the problem. You know, there is all sorts of media, well, how should I put it? The media is 100% behind a lot of the problems in this country, whether it's the war on drugs and they weave that into their sitcoms, or whether they have blatant programs that are all promoting the idea that kicking in doors and trampling people's rights and doing it without due process and warrants and the other protections that the Constitution is supposed to assure us of is okay. Certainly the ACLU is actually, in light of what's happened since 9/11 with Ashcroft and the Patriot Act and all of the other legislation that they've been coming, the laundry list, wish list that the government cops have wanted for years has been put into effect. The ACLU has just dropped $3.5 million on our media blitz, and it's not in the media much down here, but in about six major cities in the East and on the West Coast, trying to motivate people to organize at the grassroots level, passing around resolutions that local city councils and local government entities can pass, saying that, you know, advising their legislators and their police not to go along, and to just say no to these governmental overreaching efforts that things like the Patriot Act have called for. And if anyone's interested in touching base with the ACLU, I'd like to give you both an email site and a website. It's real easy. It's www.aclu.org. The email site, you can go to aclu online at aclu.org, they will give you sometimes daily email alerts on what's going on and make it real easy for you to not only contact the necessary legislators both nationally and locally, but we'll give you some ideas about resolutions that can be passed to send a message to Ashcroft and President Bush about the error of their ways.
John, I want to thank you for calling in. I wish I had an hour show every night. What can I say? There's just too much to talk about. Greg, I want to thank you for coming in. It's been a pleasure to have you here. I hope you'll come back soon and we can kick around some more of these thoughts that we just couldn't get to today.
I'll be happy to come back anytime you let me.
All right, sir. I appreciate that. I want to go ahead then and just play a couple of tracks here, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is Joe.
He's a gasoline abuser.
Fill her up, please.
This is Joe's gasoline dealer, Omar.
2364. Will that be cash or charge?
This is Omar's supplier, Abdul.
We have 10,000 gallons of premium in the truck. How much would you want?
This is Abdul's gasoline importer, Ahmed.
This oil is sweet and pure, like the virgins that await martyrs in heaven.
This is Ahmed's contact from the oil cartel, Osama.
We must make the Americans stay addicted. The money makes our jihad possible.
So if you buy gasoline, you are supporting terrorism.
It's not like I hijacked a plane with a box cutter, and I can get 20 miles a gallon.
This message brought to you by the U.S. Council of Control and Prohibition of whatever is on the president's mind today.
Okay, there are some new government ads on. You've probably seen them on TV. They focus on the drug war, and they're trying to combine the drug war with the war of terror. And they show two guys talking about the drugs, and they seem to agree that using drugs helps terrorists a little bit. And I would even agree with that statement that, you know, probably several millions make their way back to leftist guerrillas and other rebel groups. But I guarantee you that more than 1,000 times as much money, more than the drug war, makes its way back to Al-Qaeda when you buy gas from Saudi Arabia. Our government is run by lying hypocrites. Let's go to Steve now for the Activist Corner.
Thanks, Dean. We got a few things coming up. in the month of December that you can take part of and be active in your community. On Saturday, December 14th,
yeah, that's good.
Amnesty International is going to be having a write-a-thon. It's going to be at the Next Door Coffee House that Saturday, December 14th, which would be actually today. It's at the corner of Edloe and Kipling. It's going to be from noon to midnight, so write a letter or two in response to Amnesty cases. It's going to be part of a 24-hour write-a-thon to commemorate Human Rights Day, which happened just a few days ago on December 10th. Then coming up on the last Monday of each month, which would be the 30th this month, starting at 4:30 p.m., there's going to be a courthouse leafleting at the Criminal Justice Center, which is on San Jacinto and Franklin. That's being put on by Houston Normal and DPFT. They do that every month on the last Monday of each month. And also, something I noticed on the bulletin boards up here at KPFT, if you want to be active and let your representatives know what you feel about the drug war or other issues, there's a toll-free Capitol switchboard that you can call. It's 1-800-839-5276. Once again, that's 1-800-839-5276, because they won't change the laws unless they know how you feel about these laws. Well, that's it for Activist Corner. Back to you, Dean.
Thank you, Steve. I caught a bit of news on TV as I was headed in tonight, and I wanted to share it with you guys. It's about a Montgomery County police officer. His name's Kenny Allison, and he was just sentenced to 8 years in prison. Seems what he did, he broke into the police storage locker a couple of times. He stole $500 worth, 500 pounds of pot. He got a pound of coke, several guns, sold them to this guy, you know, his black market friend, I guess, and he received about $120,000. And his explanation was he got hooked on drugs as a narcotics agent, and, you know, just got in desperate straits, but turns out he was never a narcotics agent. So, anyway, obviously, Officer Allison was not a real drug dealer. He was selling pounds of pot for just over $200 a pound. I want to, if we can, Steve, can we play track 8? I want some folks to hear our drug czar administrator, Asa Hutchison. He has a few things to tell us.
I want to end with a few comments on marijuana. There are some in this conference, perhaps, and in our society, that want to legalize marijuana. They want to focus on that and not talk about perhaps heroin and marijuana cocaine, methamphetamine, but they want to focus on marijuana. They believe that it is less harmful than other drugs. And I think it's very important to be honest with our young people particularly and not paint a picture of marijuana or a specific drug that is not honest and factually based. We shouldn't over-dramatize a particular drug. But at the same time, we should not minimize the impact of a drug that is harmful, such as marijuana. In 1999, more than 200,000 Americans entered substance abuse treatment, primarily for marijuana abuse and dependence. Adolescent admissions to substance abuse facilities for marijuana grew from 43% in 1994 to 60% in 1999. I could give you specific instances of it from Dawn, a 17-year-old New Yorker who started smoking marijuana with her friends when she was age 12. She said she did it to relax on weekends, but pretty soon it became an everyday habit. And then she said this, "I learned something one day, and the next day I have no idea what the teacher was talking about." That was the impact of marijuana on her ability to learn and to recall. And so while some people are able to quit marijuana and only use it socially or recreationally, others are not so fortunate and develop serious addiction problems. Marijuana use does have consequences. It may not cause the overdose deaths like heroin or cocaine, but its cumulative effects are just as dangerous.
Okay, I've got to say this. Arrests lead to the treatment facility, not marijuana. That's just so bogus. And if some high schooler happens to forget what the teacher said the day before, we should arrest everybody that uses pot. That all makes sense somehow, I guess. I wanted to read just a couple of other news items I didn't get to earlier. There's a Rastafarian who lives in Guam who has had a ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court that says he is, in fact, entitled to smoke marijuana anywhere in the western states, as long as he's on federal land. So if he goes to Yosemite, he can smoke pot because he's a Rastafarian. In Santa Cruz, the city council has deputized the founders of a pot club. I spoke of them earlier this year, Mike and Valerie Corral of the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana. The council members said they hope the formal link between the city and the group will increase legal protections for the Corrals, who have not been charged with a crime in connection with a September raid by federal agents. The Corrals are still trying to get their seized marijuana plants back and some of their equipment from the federal government. Armed federal agents arrested the Corrals on September 5th and tore out 167 plants at their Davenport facility. Now, I want to point out one more thing here that, you know, it's up to you to change the drug war. I mean, if you're listening in and you think I'm right, if you think Greg Gladden's right, if you think Judge Gray was right, Kevin Zeese, all these people that I'm bringing on here, and I think we are right, but it's really up to you. It's up to you to create the necessary critical mass to change things. Because until the people stand up, until you stand up and dare to say, this is stupid, this is insane, it is a complete waste of time, money, and you know, potential progress. Because all this money that goes to build prisons could have been... and building schools. It could have been providing medicine and a friend told me last week that if you legalize marijuana for the U.S., by virtue of the fact you would spend $50 billion less, because that's about what we spend on it each year, and if you could tax it and make the same $50 billion, you could give insurance to every person in America with the difference there. And nobody would be harmed, except maybe this girl would forget what our teacher said yesterday. Let's see. Steve, you want to go ahead and play track 9 for them? I think they need to know where they can learn more.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. To end the drug war, visit MAPINC.org. That's MAPINC.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed, and let's bring an end to this nonsense.
I do want to thank Mark Greer and Richard Lake, all those guys at Drug Sense. They do such a great job. But then again, so does Rob Campi at the Marijuana Policy Project, wherein they are suing the drug czar. They are taking him to court for interfering in an election, specifically question 9 in Nevada, and they're trying to get him kicked out of office. A quick corrupt cop story. The competition was heavy this week with runners-up including a drug court urine tester who provided negative results in return for cash or sexual favors. And the San Francisco office of the FBI, which allowed a confidential informant to rise through the ranks of the Nuestra Familia gang, committing drug crimes and murders for some 7 months while the FBI sat back and watched. Anyway, folks, I want to let you know that if you want to learn more about what you can do, please contact Normal.
It is www.unvarnishedtruth.org. That's unvarnishedtruth, one word, .org. Please call 713-922-4367.
Or you can contact the DPFT at www.dpft.org. And thank you very much. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Mark Stepnoski of the Dallas Cowboys. For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth.